Go to tab 9 in your notebooks. We'll be cruising through a lot of material here this morning. And the purpose, the intent of this session will be to kind of help put the pieces together that we've been talking about and working on to begin to see it as a coherent whole. So let me just kind of give you an overview of these 10 pages that we have here so that you know where this discussion is going, all right? The title of it is Understanding the Context for Work and Possessions. We start out and we talk about, really, on this first two pages, the cultural context in which, you know, the Bible was written and how the particularly the household was structured. Well, then we go on and we look on page 3 at the contemporary household. We make a comparison between those two. And then we go back on the next page and we say, okay, here's the early household of the first century. Here's today's household. Now, what lessons can we take from the way Christians used the household in the first century to bring about the kind of Christianity that was spawned in the first century? How did they make that culture work to their advantage? Yeah, that's a question we'll be trying to answer. Then we say, well, of course, we can't go back to the first century. We live in the 20th century, and that's reality that we cannot deny. How do we take the lessons of the first century and apply them to the 20th century? So that's where we're going. And I think that there's a very, very important message in the midst of this material. The 500-year storm, as we were talking about it, has created a fragmented society. And we're left with pieces that we really, you know, we look at them and we can't really quite make sense of them. And we do need to understand how the pieces connect if we are going to have lives that really connect and come together. Now, here's the cultural context. Get out your pen and connect the dots here. Here's the way the first century household operated. The word is oikos. That has several meanings. It could mean, you know, somebody's home, could mean a family, but more often what it means is an extension of the family and the activities of that family within society. And so you had the family head, who was really the person that held all the pieces together. So a household was really, this is pretty complicated, I know, you know, to draw a box around this. Households, to draw a box around it, that was a household. Okay? And so the family head was usually the elder male. I guess it was always the elder male. He was considered as the defender of the group's traditions. He managed the production, the trading. And so you have this broad spectrum of things going on in the first century household. And so not only were mom and the kids there, but grandma and grandpa and maybe some uncles and cousins and so on, all in the same household. And their employment was found in the household. The trade went on. It was a part of the household activity. Servants, you'd have your apprentices in the household. And the leisure, that was found in the household. Most often education went on right there in the household as well. And religion sort of informed all of those activities, whether it was a belief in Zeus or Ares or Jesus Christ or whatever. Now, turn the page. On page 2, we have just some references, some passages, and what they give us, they're just illustrations. These passages are illustrations of the kinds of things that went on in the household. It wouldn't have had to be Bible verses. I could have used, you know, some Greek texts and things like that, but I don't have them at home. I got the Bible, so I use Bible verses. But all we're trying to do is illustrate. The only thing we're trying to do is illustrate that the household was more than the nuclear family that we're so accustomed to. So in Genesis 14, you have Abraham. He heard that his relative had been taken captive. That was Lot. He called on 318 trained men born in his household. So he had an army as a part of his household. And so they went out and pursued uh, the people that had hauled Lot off. And he recovered all the goods, brought back his relative Lot, his possessions, together with the women and the other people. And so you had Lot's household had gotten hijacked or kidnapped or whatever by some other people, and Abraham's household went and got them all back. The next passage, Genesis 18. I have chosen him so that he will direct his children and his household after him. And so it's not mom and pop and the kids, but there are other people involved there. Joshua 24:15. When Joshua confronts the people of Israel after they have gotten into the land, he says, okay, now choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods of your forefathers. You can imagine they hauled those crazy idols all the way through the desert. You know, those 40 years in the conquest of the land, they were still hauling their idols around. And now, in the final word, the confrontation, Joshua says, okay, choose who you're going to serve. As for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. Important point. The family head, one of his decisions was, you know, what this was going to consist of. And so, that's a key thought. Then Matthew 10, Jesus says, it's enough for the student to be like his teacher, the servant like his master. And so one of the things that went on in the household was, teaching, serving. And if the head of the household has been called Beelzebub, how much more the members of his household? And so he's saying, okay, my people, the people that, that belong to me, that are part of this thing that's going on around me, that's a part of the household. And then the next passage, every kingdom divided against itself will be ruined, and every city or household divided against itself will not stand. So you have two entities here, a city or a household. And so he's saying is that you can't have a household that's divided and have it survive. Now what verse comes to your mind? House divided. And the enemies, your enemies will be those of your own household. The gospel will divide households. But we need to understand just what a household is. Then Jesus said to them, only in his hometown, among his relatives, and in his own house is a prophet without honor. He's not saying that Mary and Joseph and his brothers and sisters were the ones that were having trouble with him. There was a household that Jesus is talking about. He says, yeah, even my household isn't accepting me the way they should. All the saints send you greeting, especially those belonging to Caesar's household. So the Apostle Paul, when he got thrown into prison, he managed somehow to infect Caesar's household with the virus. Now, in chapter 1, Paul says, talks about the Praetorian Guard being converted. Now, whether he's saying that the Praetorian Guard was a part of the household or whether that's something else, I don't know. But at least we know that he got to the Praetorian Guard and he also got to, into the household. So the only point is that all of these things, the point is this, that in the household, in the first century, you had employment, leisure, education, family, trade, servants, so on, and all of those were connected, they were interconnected. So now, connect the dots. And what does that tell you about the way they lived, the way they thought? There was no dichotomy. There was no divorce between the material world and the spiritual world, or work and church and those kinds of things, because it was all under one roof. Now, let's turn the page and look at how it is today. You have the nuclear family, if you're lucky, and that's mom and pop and the kids. In Stockholm, half the households have just one resident because they have a hard time staying married. In the U.S., I don't know what the number is, but it's high also. And so what goes on in the nuclear family here in our society? Well, not much. Because work is out there someplace. We go to work, and work becomes more than a way of providing our necessities today. There's the word career, and that has a lot of baggage to it. It has to do with my identity. It has to do with, my sense of worth, and so on. And in most households, you've got two of those going on. Because mom found that this is just sort of a gas station where people kind of go in and get, filled up and move on again. She says, hey, I'll, last one out, lock the door, and she's out of there too. Because, there's not enough there for it to be meaningful. So, we wouldn't dream of teaching our own children. There's a homeschool movement right now, but basically we send our kids off for education. And religion, we go to church, and that happens out there. We run into a problem, some neighbors, they're beating on each other and so on, and so we call 911, and eventually the social services come in and take care of that. Grandmother gets old and, has trouble taking care of herself, and so we send her off to a care center, and so we've institutionalized her. And one of the major institutions of our society is this one right here, the shopping malls. I mean, there's a shopping mall for every citizen. And even our meals, like Alan told us last night, 7 meals a week for the average person eating out. And, of course, leisure, we go someplace else for that, unless you call watching television leisure, and recreation. Like Junior, he's playing Little League Baseball. I got a brother who has an 8-year-old son that's in his fifth year of Little League Baseball. And, it's serious stuff. Mom and Dad are out there. It's almost like playing with these remote control cars where, you're racing your car, only you're racing your kid out there and making sure that he's kind of the star of the game. So that's become institutionalized. And so, what's happened here? This is the way our society is. What does this tell us about everyday life? Well, we just read down the list here. Everything is outsourced. Everything happens out there somewhere else. It makes life awfully busy. We're either coming or going. The busiest element in our family is the car, because we're either taking somebody someplace or we're going someplace ourselves. And it promotes privatization, because in every situation we're in a different role. And so over here they don't know what we are here. Or over here when we go and check on our kids, they don't know what we are here. What we are here and what we are here can be two different things, and we get away with that real easily. And so what happens is the tendency to, privatization, whatever you believe, keep it to yourself. We are different people for different occasions, and it compartmentalizes life into unrelated segments. Everything is institutionalized. From education to the kids' sports to church to poverty. And the problem with this is that institutions are mindless things. We need them. We have to have them. Because there are certain things that if you don't institutionalize them, it just becomes onerous for everybody. Certain systems need to be institutionalized. But we institutionalize the wrong things. And what happens is that programs replace relationships. And so, an institution is a structure that operates on policies, and then bureaucracies play out the policies. And, so you go to somebody with a perfectly logical case of something that needs to happen, and what's the answer? We can't do that. Well, why not? We have a policy against it. And that ends the discussion. You're stuck, because a policy is a mindless thing, and people can hide behind a policy relieve themselves of the moral responsibility to make a serious choice. That's the problem with institutions. And so it never occurs to us to assume certain responsibilities that are really ours. You know, we resolve needs by, you know, looking for the appropriate institution. You know, your wife or your husband needs some spiritual intake, so you encourage him to go get into a Bible study. And come home, well, how was the Bible study, dear? Oh, just fine. And you think, well, I'm glad that's going well. And, you know, that's the end of the deal. Teaching our children, you know, especially teaching our children to follow Christ. You know, you look around for a good summer camp. You look around for a good Sunday school. And it would never dawn on you to think, hey, that's really on my plate. I have a friend who was talking to me about it. He's a doctor. He says, I got in my car one Sunday morning, and he says, I looked around to back out of my garage, and there were my six kids. And he thought, you know, the last time I saw my six kids was when I looked around to back my car out last week. And he said, it dawned on me that I don't really have any relationship with my kids. And he was complaining to me about the youth worker in the church that he was going to. And I said, Bill, when you stand before God, and he says, you know, Bill, I want to talk to you about your kids, it is not going to wash for you to say, well, you know, that youth worker never was worth anything. God's going to hold you accountable. And so what happens is we because we've got the institutions out there, we think they have the responsibility, but we can't walk away from it. Or just to serve the needy. And so the fact is that this is the way life is. And as I got in the bottom line here, we probably like it that way. I mean, no muss, no fuss. We can outsource everything. Any problem that comes along, we can find an appropriate institution. And so that leaves us free to do nothing. Okay. Fitting the message about Christ into these two scenarios. In the first century, where this was the scenario, you can see the advantage to this. Because if the gospel could get into this family, I mean, it had access to an awful lot of people and to a lot of things. See, gone is the divorce between the material and the spiritual, for one thing. So here are some references, and I want you to read them to yourselves. By the way, we were sitting like this today because we're going to break into discussions, and I don't want to have to get up and move around. That's a waste of time. And so we're going to be talking to each other at the tables. I see there are only four guys there. We got one guy sitting back there in the corner there. You need to join these guys over here. And so what I want you to do is read these two pages of references, pages 4 and 5. Now, you can read them out loud in 3 minutes. I prefer that you read them to yourself. First time you go through it, just underline the word household, house, or home. Okay? Read through them, underline the word household, house, or home. And then, after you've gone through and underlined it, go back and ask the question that we've got at the top there, new meaning to old verses. You see that? What was the place of the household in the growth of the gospel? Okay, the point is that you can never separate the individual from his house. I mean, that was just a part of him, from his religion. I mean, it was all one deal. And now we're talking about material possessions here. And that just kind of went into the mix. Whatever we had, we used. And we'll be looking at that further. But you see, there's no dichotomy. It's not, what do I do with my possessions? Well, my possessions just help me do a better job of this. And then there's some other things which we'll get into. And so, you know, the church was never far from your life. Now, we use the word church. Let me use the word ecclesia here, or gathering. the gathering of God. It was never far from your life. I mean, it was at home. You get up in the morning, and it's a part of it. It's a part of everyday life. Incidentally, in verse Romans 16, 5 through 6 here on this page 5, it says the word, greet also the church that meets at their house. The word meets is not in the original. The translators were so used to thinking about meeting in church that they just put that in there. And you have the very same thing in 1 Corinthians 16, 19. The church that meets at their house, the bottom line, that is not in the original. And down on Philemon 1, no, it's Philippians 1 through 2, the church that meets in your home, that word meets is not in the original. But just because we think what churches do is meet, we've put that in there. But the fact is that your home was your church. And so you can see the implications of that. Now, turn the page. There were almost no church buildings for the first 300 years of Christian history. Homes were used. A church would consist of about 30 people. Often, but not always, the nucleus of a church would be a household. You know, so there are exceptions. We're just taking this as the general flow of the way things worked. Now, this I want you to discuss at your tables. Imagine your home as a church, as the church for your family and circle of friends, and that they look to you for leadership. What would that do to you? Okay, talk about it. All right, turn the page. And I just want to call your attention to this page because it really has to fit into our discussion or into the subject, but we are not going to take the time to discuss it. The New Testament carries this concept of household one step further, and this is absolutely fascinating to me, that God has a household. Part of this household, which is the church, is in heaven. And so he says, we are fellow citizens with God's people, members of God's household. Last verse there, verse 22 there, says, in him you too are being built together to become a dwelling in which God lives by his Spirit. And so he talks about a heavenly household in this passage. And that is something that we are already a part of. Phenomenal, unbelievable thought. But then he puts it down on earth again, and he said, the household that you are, God lives in it. That's a big thought. Then he goes on, and 1 Timothy 3:15 says the same thing. If I'm delayed, you'll know how people ought to conduct themselves in God's household, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and foundation of the truth. I think that what really is going on today, what's it all about? Well, I think what it's all about is that God is creating a household, a people, his family. So let's leave this page. Just wanted to sow that seed in your mind. And now we're back to modern times. It would be foolish to attempt, I'm reading right out of the notes here, I follow them sometimes, it would be foolish to attempt to return to the ways and forms of the first century church. They simply used the existing social structure to the advantage of the gospel. Now underline that. They used the existing social structure to the advantage of the gospel. We need to learn to do the same. You know, it's ridiculous to try to go back and create households the fashion that existed in the first century. So we need to apply the principles they lived by rather than attempting to reconstruct their forms. Okay? Well, oh, yeah, isn't that... Yeah, I had you scared there for a while, didn't I? Yeah, man. Let me continue. What is the message of the first century for us? The gospel binds believers to God and to one another. Reconciliation with God entails reconciliation with one another. It has social outworkings. It leads to community. It is impossible to live out the gospel without being meaningfully engaged with one another. The following verses illustrate this fact. Romans 12, 10-13. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Honor one another above yourselves. Share with God's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. None of us lives to himself alone. Bear with the failings of the weak. Each please his neighbor. Accept one another as Christ accepted you. The body's parts should have equal concern for each other. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as in Christ God forgave you. Each one should use whatever gift he has received to serve one another. This is a sample of over 60 passages that use this phrase, one another, in the New Testament, or in the epistles. How can I learn patience without you to test it? Forgiveness if you never offend me. Generosity if you never need anything. And how can I recover when I crash if you're not there to help put me back together? Keep pressing on if you don't encourage me. Do what I need to do but can't if you don't help me. How can I love no one? So our reconciliation to God through Christ results in our being reconciled to one another, to our spouses, our children, our fellow believers, our neighbors, our associates, and even our enemies. But the challenge for us is, how do we live this out? This is a truth for all times. This is not something that we can say, well, that was the first century. This is for now. And so the question is, in a disconnected world, how do we begin to live the principles that the scriptures give us in our setting? Turn to page 9. We need to start giving things back, taking things back. We have given away the farm, and there's nothing left for us to do but watch. We become passive observers of life, and that gets boring very quickly. You know, my old buddies, when, you know, we grew up together, and I meet them now, and the most frequent attitude I pick up from them is a feeling of boredom, that they've done the drill, they've made the formations, and, they've done everything according to, the rules, and they're bored out of their minds. And that's the reason right there. We outsourced everything. So we watch our kids in Little League. We go to church and watch and listen. We watch football. I mean, we watch everything. Yes?
The operative word is isolation.
Yeah, isolation. And that's just absolutely unbearable. And most people, that's the way they live. So what do we need to take back? Here are some examples. Care for our spouses. When we moved to Brazil in 1963, I suddenly looked around and there was no church to send my wife to. We didn't know any Christians. It was just the two of us and our little baby daughter. And it dawned on me that I had been farming her out all her life because there was no place for her to go. And this passage that I have here just hit me between the eyes. It says, "Husbands, love your wives. Give yourself up for her to make her holy, to present her to Christ as a radiant person without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, holy and blameless." When I stand before God, God's going to say, "Well, Jim, let's talk about Marge. I noticed that you really have not been doing some of this stuff that I told you in Ephesians 5. And I realized that is a responsibility that, according to the Scriptures, I cannot dodge. I cannot institutionalize my wife to get her to become the kind of godly woman that she's supposed to be. That is my deal. Same thing with my children. I gave you the wrong verses there. Deuteronomy 6, 3 through 6, and then the next verses, 7, 8, and 9. I want to read those to you. 7, 8, and 9. says, these commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, and when you get up. In other words, it's on your plate, Dad and Mom, to raise your kids. Nobody else is going to be held accountable but you. And so that's something we cannot give away. We have got to take back, just as we have to take back the responsibility for our spouses. Are we really helping our spouses walk with Christ? Are we helping our kids walk with Christ? And I remember sitting down and thinking, as you know, they were my kids, no place to go, no place to send them. What do they need to know to become godly people? And I remember working that out with my wife, and we went after it, sharing the message. Kind of a backhanded verse here. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after that time. I will put my laws in their minds, write them on their hearts. I will be their God. They will be my people. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, know the Lord, because they will all know me. And I have an editorial here. Until then, we do teach our neighbor. In other words, he's saying he just kind of takes it for granted. Hey, everybody's supposed to teach their neighbor. Everybody's supposed to teach their neighbor, know the Lord. Until the time when everybody knows him. And that time hasn't come yet. So that's something we've got to take back. We can't give that away. I've got this little study group of people who haven't been Christians very long. And they're the kind of people that would never dream of darkening the door of a church. And now one of the couples has a grandson that's into hard drugs and tried to take his life. And so, you know, they're kids, you know, the couple. They're struggling, and the other siblings there are, you know, worrying, our kid's going to go the same route and all of that kind of stuff. And so there I am in the Bible study, and here are these people who are plotting how to get these kids and these families into church. Well, that's the most ridiculous thing in the world. As if getting them to church is going to solve something. Come on, give me a break. Those same people, 2 years ago, would never think of darkening the door of a church. And if they had gone in, it wouldn't have done anything for them. We take that responsibility back to ourselves. Now, church has its place, but that is not the place that it has. We have a church that's full of people who are going there, you know, bunching the time card. And that's the long and the short of it. So that's something we have to take back. Serving the needy. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress and keep oneself from being polluted by the world. And so one of the things that we need to do, if all of this is going to come together for us, is we're going to have to choose those things that we need to take back. And as we sort through those things, all of these things, and we see that some of these things that we're into have nothing to do with really anything that's important in our lives, we need to just throw those out. We need to discard those things that have us, you know, like the guy that leaped on his horse and rode off in all directions. You know, a lot of things there, we don't have to go there. We don't have to do that. Discard those things. And to begin to bring together those elements in our lives that really contribute to a cohesive lifestyle. Turn to page 10. Our material possessions are a God-given resource that enables us to participate more fully in God's purposes. Once we begin to think this way, then our material possessions begin to make sense. Until we're thinking this way, forget it. They aren't going to make sense. Look at this first verse here. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it is gone, the worldly wealth, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Now, what do you think about that? Let's read on. Whoever can be trusted with very little can be trusted with much. Whoever is dishonest with very little will be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, or, you know, what was it, ungodly mammon or something like that, but he's talking about money anyway, either case. He's talking about money. Who will trust you with true riches? Keep going. Then Jesus said to his host, this is an illustration, I think, of what we have here in Luke 16. When you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or relatives, or your rich neighbors. If you do, they will invite you back and you will be repaid. So you can, you know, use your material possessions, throw a barbecue, invite your friends over, and then, you know, you have a great time. And then it's their turn. And so you invite this predictable group of people that you've always hung out with, and then they invite you, and it's all predictable. And after 20 years of this, you know, it's 40 meals at their house, 40 meals at your house. You've broken even. It hasn't cost you a dime. But he says, when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. That's the biblical description of the unbeliever. And you will be blessed, although they cannot repay you. You will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. And so what he's really saying is use your hospitality, your house, your kitchen, your groceries, and your barbecue pit to just bring people around. And what you have to offer is more than food. It's an eternal message. They can never repay you for that. You will get paid when you come walking into glory, and there are these people over here who you first connected with on your deck. And they say, hey, you know, salute Dwight Hill. If it hadn't been for his barbecue, we wouldn't be here in the kingdom. And so what he's saying is, use what you've got for the sake of eternal purposes. I think that's what that first verse means. Build a relationship with what you've got. Anything you own is a vehicle, a means to people, access to people. And then, again, we're talking about material possessions and how they serve as a resource in God's purposes. May the Lord show mercy to the household of Onesiphorus, because he often refreshed me, was not ashamed of my chains. On the contrary, when he was in Rome, he searched hard for me until he found me. May the Lord grant that he will find mercy from the Lord on that day. You know very well in how many ways he helped me in Ephesus. And so just having the means to be able to serve a person and get them out of trouble and make life more comfortable for them, you know, that's an eternal thing. And so really what we're asking for here is a mind shift. We need to think oikos, mentally stitch the pieces of our fractured lives back together. And those things that don't fit, just don't fit. We throw them out. And so, in that way, our business life, our material possessions, and all of it becomes an integral part of God's purpose, which is building an eternal household.